Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In our last talk on transport, there is inevitably a bit of an eclecticism, because however much one tries to be a revisionist, it would be difficult to say that the late 19th, 20th and early 21st centuries was the high point of the British engagement with maritime and inland waterway travel. And there is also the need to say something about air travel. And there is also the need to say something in conclusion. So there will be a slightly eclectic, slightly jumping around feel, but in a way that is symptomatic of a transport world which over the last 150 years was dominated by rail and then increasingly by road. But listeners of the previous programmes would realise, of course, that I'm also trying to look at the extent to which non-rail, non-road transport continued. I was pointing out last time that there still was significant canal travel in the mid-19th century, but it's also fair to say that actually it was coming towards a close. So, for example, the canal from Carlisle to Port Carlisle closed in 1853 and was converted into the Port Carlisle Railway. Or in Plimbridge Woods, the railway was built on the canal towpath to bring stone and peat from Dartmoor to Plymouth. On the other hand, it's fair to say that there was still a degree of significance in the late 19th century. And in part, this was because steam technology could be used on canals just as it could be used on railways. So, for example, in 1871 to 1897, the Weaver Navigation, Northwest England, was rebuilt with the locks replaced by a turbine-operated hydraulic lock gate, a hydraulic boat lift to link the Weaver to the Trent and Mersey Canal, and a dredging, a steam dredging, of the main channel of the Weaver. All of which indicates the way in which the application of new technology could actually help a pre-existing form of transport. And as well, you know, one notes competition, but it's as well to note there was cooperation as well as competition between rail and waterways. And that was the case both in domestic transport and in maritime transport. I mean, the obvious point is that maritime transport depended pretty well totally on the railways in this period in order to provide the goods for export and in order to move on goods that were imported. So if you're looking at harbour works in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Hull, for example, has an enormous expansion of its harbour capacity from the 1880s. I think the major one is the Queen Alexandra one, opened in 1885, I think. And then I think the George V one is opened in 1914. And this is an enormous expansion, which, of course, is linked very carefully to the expansion of railways, particularly the Northeastern Railway. And in turn, and I think there's the Barnsley and Selby Railway as well. And in turn, the ports make sense of the railways. Ditto on the other bank of the Humber, where the Immingham dock is, I think, completed in 1912. And that, again, is linked to the railways to move, in this case, Lincolnshire ore, iron ore in particular. And it's worth saying that if you take Devon, my county, of the 3 million tonnes of traded goods crossing the Devon County boundary in 1913, only just over 1 million tonnes were carried by rail, and far more coal came to Devon by sea than rail. Although I think it's worth saying that the problems posed by statistics are enormous, so coal minerals and other goods landed at ports that were outside the county and then moved on by rail would count simply as a rail journey, and there wouldn't be any reference to sea. Coal in particular came from South Wales by both rail and sea. So I think it's worth saying that one's got this situation in the late 19th century, and linked to that, of course, although the percentage of goods moved by inland waterway is falling, coastal travel remains very important, particularly for coal. Indeed, if you're looking at the maps that accompany the Beeching Report in the early 1960s, there is a map in it of coal movements. That's the only commodity apart from passengers that is mapped separately. I mean, obviously, goods as a whole are mapped. And you will notice, if you look at that map, there is still coastal movements of coal in some appreciable quantity from the Tyne to London. And that's the 1960s. And you go back earlier, if you think of John Masefield's Three Ages of Maritime Travel, Quinquereme of the Middle East, a stately Spanish galleon, and an English tramp steamer going up the channel. The English tramp steamers going along the channel were, of course, not just taking British manufactured goods to continental markets, and vice versa, they were also moving goods between British ports. And that remained very important. Of course, it's worth bearing in mind that one of the very major routes was linking up to a major centre of British world, which was Dublin, which remained a major centre of the British world till the early 1920s, and which could only be reached at that stage by steamer. Of course, steamers themselves were hit quite hard by the impact of World War I. German submarine attack, notably, but not only, on the vulnerable North Sea coastal shipping, and they were exposed greatly to German attack because of the German seizure of the Belgian ports of Zeebrugge, Ostend, and Antwerp, and the possibility of, as well, of an attack by surface warfare, created problems for British coastal trade, and indeed led to the sinking of large quantities of shipping, not just by torpedo or by artillery from submarines, but also, of course, by mines they had laid. That had already led, before the war, to the decision to pay much more of an emphasis on rail transport on in movements along the East Coast, particularly of coal again. It's also worth saying that you're starting immediately after World War I, as I mentioned, to see aircraft. And I just want to say one or two things about that. I mean, it really moves, the technology moves very fast, as it had done with rail in the sense of the application of steam. So first flight by, first powered flight by humans is 1903. Immediately after World War I, you've got the post-war establishment of air services. These compete with railways. Now, particularly on the London-Paris route, which was a route which was dependent on steamship and rail. So from 1919, Hounslow Heath Aerodrome, where Heathrow now is, service developed to Le Bourget in Paris. From 1920, Cricklewood Aerodrome, where the Golders Green Estate was to be built, was also the base for Paris services, as was Croydon Airport, which opened in 1920 on the site of two aerodromes, and which became Britain's leading airport. As so often, wartime, in this case, leading to the accumulation of skills and infrastructure, including aerodromes, helped to provide the background for post-war enterprise. By 1921, six companies operated a London to Paris service. Of course, the airplanes were small, but six operated a service, and the Croydon-Le Bourget route became the busiest in the world in the early 1920s. There were also flights from London to Amsterdam and to Rotterdam from 1920, to Berlin from 1923, and the airport was greatly expanded in 1926 to 28. But I think it's worth saying that the London to Paris example in part was a matter of competition with the cross-channel ferries. In contrast, if you're looking at overland rapid train services within the British Isles, these benefited from their city centre to city centre character, which aircraft couldn't do, and also from the small carrying capacity of aircraft, which were also vulnerable to weather conditions and far more so than trains. Moreover, air services were much more expensive than trains, not least because they didn't have the capacity, and had a higher accident rate. Airships appeared to offer a potential for longer range services, but accidents, especially the crashing of the poorly conceived R101 in 1930 on its first flight, helped ensure failure. The same time, as an interesting example of bridging, and I've already referred to that in the linkage between rail and sea, and of course there were, as you'll know, are sea services that belong to the railway companies. The same thing happened with air services. In 1933, the Great Western Railway Air Service began a twice daily weekly service between Plymouth and Cardiff via Halden Airfield near Exeter. That is not the modern Exeter Airfield. It's in fact an airfield on the Halden Hills southwest, where, I mean, I've been there, you can still see among the shrub the remains of the runway. It's not, nothing else really to see. And that service was later extended in 1933 to Birmingham. So Plymouth and Cardiff via Exeter to Birmingham. In 1934, the big four railway companies and Imperial Airways formed the Railway Air Service, which linked with the international flights of the railway of Imperial Airways, in other words, through ticketing and all the rest of it. And this company continued until it was nationalised in 1947. The main base was Croydon Airport, and the major route was between London and Glasgow. And most people know nothing about that, but in fact, it was a quite important route for those people that were in a hurry. And it showed that over a sufficient long journey, the competition with rail was effective, though I think it's fair to say that that would not have been the case on shorter journeys. Having said that, a fair number of enthusiasts, of course, were able to make their own arrangements, either owning planes, or you could rent a plane or hire a plane, and that would have been done by quite a few people. If we're looking at the early 20th century, of course, there is still some expansion, a little bit in canals. So in 1911, Cadbury's established a new factory at Knighton on the Shropshire Union Canal, producing condensed milk, which was then moved to the Cadbury Works at Bourneville near Birmingham on the Worcester and Birmingham Canal. Equally, the canal, that company, Cadbury's, moved cocoa from London and Southampton by rail. But Cadbury's was relatively unusual, as well as obviously coal, which still made a lot of use of canals, particularly linked to the Trent River system. Rail and road hit canal traffic hard. So, for example, in Berkshire, commercial traffic on the Wilts and Berks Canal stopped in 1906. The canal closed in 1914. And on the Kennet and Avon Canal, traffic had all but ceased by 1939, whereas now it's a major leisure canal. In his London is a Muddle, which came out in 1937, E.M. Forster commented on the largely disused nature of London canals, writing, "Occasionally a string of barges passes through behind a tug on its way to the docks," and the optimum phrase was "occasionally." But canals continued to be significant in some areas. J.B. Priestley, referring in 1929 to industrial Brudersford, which was for Huddersfield, quote, "That streak of slime must be the Leeds and Liverpool Canal or the Aire and Calder Canal." That streak of slime, rather a nice phrase, I think. In response to wage cuts, and the wage cuts reflected the pressure on the system, as indeed with rail. The canal strike of 1923 saw about 500 boats on strike. The Times observed on the 13th of September 23, the canals are relatively so small a part of the transport system of the country. Also noted the difficult nature of the job, as well as it being separate to society. Canal boatmen are a class very much apart from others. A moving home, live on the boat, crew his wife and the children, who are old enough to lend a hand. The children have little or no schooling. The wages were, quote, downwards from £2 a week, and this meant that the boatmen could not afford homes on land. John Betjeman captured a sense of canals as past in his poem. The gas was on in the Institute, a lass was singing a hymn, when Captain Webb, the Dawley man, Captain Webb from Dawley, came swimming along the old canal that carried the bricks to Lawley. The spread of motor vehicles also hit coastal steamship services by adding a new dimension to the already existing competition from rail and by filling the gaps between railheads, which reduced the opportunities for coastal services. So as steamship services were cut, seaside settlements lost their function as regular ports. For example, the weekly cargo and passenger service to Barmouth in Wales, provided by the Aberdovian Steamship Company, ended in 1915. And the same was more generally the case, that there was, I think it's fair to say, let fewer and fewer coastal services. The roads, of course, the improvement in trunk roads in the interwar years reduced opportunities. And that also included tackling some of the obstacles posed by estuaries, obstacles which had, of course, encouraged the use of steamships. So in 1934, there was what was the longest underwater tunnel in the world, the road link under the Mersey between Liverpool and Birkenhead. And of course, what that did was dramatically reduce the need for shipping across the Mersey. There were other new systems other than air, and a crucial system which tends to be forgotten when people talk about transport arose as a result of the Electricity Supply Act of 1926, which established a national grid for electricity under the control of the Central Electricity Board, creating integrated supply areas and erecting overhead lines accordingly. So, for example, in 1931, the North Wales Power Company erected an overhead line across the Menai Straits and Anglesey at about the cost of about £29 million. A grid of about 4,000 miles was completed by 1933. It's one of the major achievements of Britain in the interwar years. And it was a very important transport system, as also, of course, with oil pipelines, with oil moved from landing places to refineries and so on. And one of the interesting things is that if you ask people about transport, they tend to ignore it, but it's crucial, just as today, the internet and other related forms, the use of satellites, are all very important today. Labour government very much nationalised a lot of transport, not just railways, including related assets such as shipping owned by the railways in 1948, civil aviation, canal transport in 48, and indeed some road haulage in 48. And all of which this led to a measure of centralisation, to centralise labour bargaining, which pushed up prices for the industries, and to a process, you can guess it, of what was called rationalisation. Well, rationalisation, of course, meant essentially a internal politics in which people made their pitches for their particular issues. We most famously saw it, of course, with the Beeching Report and railways, which in a way was a reflection of the failure of the rail modernisation plan of the mid-50s. Well, there was also a waterways modernisation plan of 1955, which stipulated modest improvement with it. I did write it down, the number of miles, but it stipulated modest improvement for a small number of miles. It stipulated, as it were, service like normal for about 994 miles, I think it was, and getting rid of them for about 771, or the other way around of those two. But the key thing is, there was also a process of so-called rationalisation on the waterways. In 1955, the report of the Board of Survey on Canals and Inland Waterways recommended the development of 336 miles of canals and inland waterways, the retention of 994 miles, and the abandonment of 771 miles. Critics pointing out that what this meant was that the 994 ones were likely to be to go as well. And indeed, much of the canal system went. The argument being that, of course, unless it could be improved to certain specifications and to carry certain amount of freight, it wasn't worth preserving the canals. What ironically happened, of course, is that canals went to a different direction to railways. In the case of canals, there was a much greater limitation of the network for carrying freight, the prime network, but than there was in the case of rail. But in the case of canals, whereas there was actually only so much of railway enthusiasts networking, actually canals took over a large chunk of the surviving network, which remains the case today. Of the other forms of transport in this post-war world, a natural gas system was to be set up to move North Sea gas, and that was very important. Replacing in a way a lot of the dependence on town gas or coal gas, which therefore further diminished the need to move coal around the country by either train or canal. Air did have domestic air services develop, and a network of regional airports was created greater than that today. For example, as example of one that went in 1951, Don Everill, a Wolverhampton coach operator, established an airline, Don Everill Aviation, which began scheduled services in 1953. But Wolverhampton lost its airport in 1970. Passengers on domestic flights rose tenfold from 1951 to 1970, but in the latter year, 1970, only comprise 0.5% of passenger miles. And I think it's fair to say that although there are domestic air services today, they are again, as with the late 1930s and the London to Glasgow one, they're principally important on distant routes. So you can see London to Edinburgh, London to Glasgow, London to Aberdeen or Inverness, air services also out to Scottish islands like Stornoway. All of those are important. But I think in terms of domestic potential, for reasons of economics, but also of supposed concern with the environment, there has been always a restriction on air services that are less than 200 miles. And that, I think, is significant. The major London airfield that could make a bit of difference, Northolt, it doesn't really configure itself for domestic air services. Heathrow is and Gatwick are relatively well connected, but places and city airports quite central, but places that used to have air services no longer do so. And also, I think it's worth pointing out that Flybe, which based for, most recently in Southampton, had quite a significant domestic network. That's gone. And if you take, not that it's important, but just I know about it, if you take Exeter, for example, air services that it used to have to London City Airport or to Norwich Airport have gone. So domestic air services have not gone particularly well. Hovercrafts, another technology of the post-war years, had the first commercial service from Ramsgate to Calais beginning in 1978. And there was obviously services around the Isle of Wight, but did not really become a major national system. So we're, as it were, flickering out in a way. Coastal shipping was hit by the marked decline in shipbuilding, in part due to international competition. There are still cruises round the British Isles, particularly attractive to the elderly, as there's no need to take a flight, which had insurance implications. But the movement of coal by coastal shipping has largely ceased. And there's not much else that is moved by coastal shipping. Rubbish, actually, is one of the major things. I've said, obviously, nothing about trams or trolley buses. Trolley buses have gone. Interestingly enough, London had had a maximum fleet of 1,811 trolley buses and the largest system in the world. But the last London trolley bus was in 1963. Trams largely ceased in the 1950s, though Glasgow had its last one in 1962. More recently, there's been a revival in Croydon, in Manchester, in Sheffield and Wolverhampton as trams, now seen as a viable alternative to buses. But of course, they're not an alternative to buses as long distance transport. They're more an alternative in commuting. Now, when we started off these, which for me, the research has been very hard, but I have found it interesting. I little thought we'd be ending up with trams. But let me try and give one or two general reflections, if I may. And that is that in a sense, Britain played a very important role technologically, particularly with both turnpiking and even more canals in the 18th century and with rail in the 19th century. I think it's fair to say that it's not been able to sustain that, and that for many individuals, transport in Britain is not particularly attractive, that the networks are crowded, and the real cost is onerous. But that doesn't mean it's less important as a subject. And one of the difficulties I feel is that we have a triumphant history which very much focuses on the past, and we're a little inclined to therefore not adopt a focus on the present and a historical perspective necessary for that. For those people who are interested in history, the abysmal record of High Speed Train 2 should have been no surprise, because it was very similar to many of the projecting euphoria ideas of the 19th century. The difference in this case, as a result of, in a sense, the Labour Party in the 40s and the concept of public investment, is that unfortunately the taxpayer ended up with a very significant bill. I think on the whole, what I would say is it's always best to look for incremental improvements, both in the infrastructure and in the running organisation of systems, rather than to think of bold new projects, many of which are poorly conceived. And far as the last is concerned, I would say that at the present moment, the biggest instance of that is electric vehicles, making them compulsory, which I think is an astonishing risk in terms of cost and also, incidentally, reliability, infrastructure, and also the pollution implications of the batteries. So what one sees repeatedly is that public remedies, public solutions are not necessarily best, But unfortunately, most of the people that write on transport tend to have a built-in prejudice that they are, which helps to explain why some of the literature on the history of transport is misconceived. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. I just want to try and really tie these different aspects of transport in the 20th century together by asking about really the role of the Ministry of Transport in having to adjudicate between the various rationalizations of supposedly dying forms of transport like canals and emerging forms of transport like planes and cars. How do you feel, and this is very much an overview of the 20th century question, how do you feel transport policy at government level has evolved to direct where the money went and where the rationalisation took place?
I'm not sure that I'm always particularly impressed by the strategic skill of civil service departments that tend to be run by, how shall one put it, by those who very much act as a particular lobby, both for themselves, obviously, and for their market, their suppliers, rather than for considering overall public value, including actually literally financial value. And I would argue the same is more generally true of across public service. I think, for example, ministry after ministry goes native. I'm afraid to say one of the worst is the Ministry of Defence, but you could argue Ministry of Health, because that's more Department of Health, that's more even more expensive. Obviously, universities, as we are going to be discussing soon, are no advertisement for the system of a corporatist state. So I think that on the whole, the views of the consumer, the individual consumer, and the consumer as a collectivity, whether it is drivers or rail passengers, are underplayed. And there's too much concern with a systemic approach on the part of relations between managers and unions, and between a desire for big is better. And it's partly as a result of that that you end up with a situation in which there are only two constraints on these processes within government as a whole. One is the actual exhaustion of finance, which is what really killed HS2. In many senses, it was COVID and the impact of spending all the money on COVID that did for it. And second of all, I think it's the degree to which there is a often quite obstinate refusal of events and individuals, the public as a whole, to cooperate with what are theoretically brilliant blue skies ideas. And we can see this in public hostility towards ULEZ. I think it's fair to say that if it wasn't the case that the Conservatives are very highly unpopular, which they are, it would be more of a possibility that Mr. Khan would be losing the London mayoralty, which would have hit the ULEZ, his proposal. Low-speed traffic neighbourhoods, which are farcical. I mean, they look good in theory, but they're farcical. And in a sense, this is a problem. There is too little attention is played to the poor sod standing in the bus queue, or, you know, trapped in a car that can't move, or affected by some, you know, strike by conceited rail unions. And there's far too little concern about those. That's an aspect of life in Britain at the moment, but it is a disheartening aspect of life in Britain.
Well, it's a disheartening aspect of life to end on, but this has been a fascinating series, mostly about the waterways, the canals, and ending with an overview into how those connect into the other forms of transport in the 20th century and into the 21st as well. For all this, taking us on this journey, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And can I thank listeners for their patience? It means a lot to me because obviously the work is hard. I mean, you get quite a lot of rather glib podcasting about history and current affairs in which people, shoot from the hip. I've actually done a lot of work for this, and it means a lot that I know that there is a small group, but a small group of listeners who are interested in having an informed discussion. And I'd like to think that this is the best of the available podcasts on history. It's certainly obviously nowhere near the ones that yield large audiences and significant revenues. But I think quality is a key point, and I suspect most of the others will be ephemeral in their impact.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.